Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds like a whisper. Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare line.
Tickle Theatre and Revolution in the 20th Century. Presented by the Theatre Studies Program of the Mediterranean Institute at the University of Malta, coordinated by Dr. Vicky Ann Cremona. Today's program is about Dario Fo with Simone Spiteri and Franica Police.
Where are people gonna rise up and get their share?
Hello, Franica. Hello, Simone. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this program. As I said in the introduction to the program, we are going to be speaking today about a very important revolutionary character within the theatre of the 20th century, Dario Fo. Dario Fo, who is well known, I'm sure, to our listeners, because he is the first actor to have obtained the Nobel Prize for Literature. Franica and Simone, you have done some considerable research about Dario Fo, and I'd like us to start by talking about his early life, the part we don't know, the non-public part.
Okay. Basically, he was born in 1926 in a small province of Milan in Italy, and he came from a very normal family. I mean, his father was a railroad worker, and his mother had a peasant background. However, it's interesting to know that his father was a part-time actor, so that might have influenced him a bit. But another important thing is, not important, it's interesting, that during the Second World War, he helped his father to help soldiers, Allied soldiers, to get across the border to Switzerland. When he grew up, he attended art school. Initially, he wanted to be an architect, actually, rather than a theatre person. But then it was when he started with his early works and one-act farces which he kind of found his feet in theatre.
Right, and when was that, really? How did he start his professional career?
I think 1953 was the year when he grabbed the attention of critics for the first time with a play called Il Dito nell'Occhio. However, I think critical acclaim really came with Archangels Don't Play Pinball in 1960. Dario Fo started with controversy from the beginning of his career. I mean, we know that, for example, in 1962, Fo and his wife Franca Rame, which is important to mention her because she was his partner both in life and on the stage, they were participants in a very family oriented program called Canzonissima on Rai. The ideologies they were portraying in their sketches was not to the station's liking, and their pieces were edited. They were not actually fired from the program, but for Andrama, they felt that they had to stick by their principles, so they left instead of staying and compromising their work. And it's important to know that it was such a huge scandal that they were banned from working on Rai for the next 15 years, and the actors' union forbade any other actor to replace them during the program.
Yes, in fact, it created in itself a political struggle, because
exactly.
On the one hand, you have the actors' union who is trying to support them by not allowing anybody to replace them, and on the other, you have the institution which is coming down heavily on them, because to
yes.
be banned from the Rai at the time, mm-hmm. particularly, was cutting yourself a huge source of publicity.
Yes, exactly.
And a huge source of fame. In fact, I think they were pushed into then just doing work in the theatre,
yes.
which they carried out very effectively, going around Italy anyway. I'd just like to come back onto the first Years just before they go to Canzonissima, though, because I think it's important to state that Dario Fo started creating satirical sketches from the very, very beginning of his career, in the sense that even before putting up Un dito nell'occhio, he starts satirizing, like one the scholars, exactly, starts creating one-act forces in the theatre, and he starts also criticizing things like the Italian scholastic system, like certain personalities, in a very, and already we begin to see the influence of his, of what is later going to develop, which is grotesque.
Exactly.
Okay, so I think this is important to state. But this, and this also, the dito, il dito nell'occhio is continued. He doesn't do it alone. He starts... he starts actually on the radio before going to television. And it's quite important, because if you compare this, for example, to writers like Francis Abeyer in Malta, Francis Abeyer himself starts on the radio, writing radio plays, and then moves to the theatre. So it seems to be a kind of natural process.
Yes.
And in a sense, he in when he goes on to presenting Sani dalle gare, which is the second the second performance he puts up after Il dito nell'occhio, he ridicules, together with his friends Franco Parenti and Giustino Durano, the everyday life of Italians, their habits, etc. So you have come to Canzonissima, and you were telling us about the way he was thrown out of the television.
Yes, I think Canzonissima leads us to a very important period in his life. We're basically focusing on his communist ideologies and his communist traits in his work. And when we were researching, we thought that the period of his life which kind of signifies this ideology most was basically 1967 to 1974. And the fact that as far back as in 1962 he was already in trouble with the law further evokes that how he was in trouble with other laws and even bigger institutions by 1967, because we know that, for example, in a play called La Signorina da Buttare, he comments about the Kennedy assassination, he comments about Vietnam, and in fact his comments about the Kennedy assassination, it brings about, he's refused a visa for the United States. This is a very important thing, because as we will go along, we will see that Dario Fo's work is always mirroring some current world event. He doesn't talk or put up work in a vacuum. He's always being relevant to something which is happening at the same time in the world.
And so how does he go along to bring across this ideology, this communist ideology? After all, we know that in 1967, Franca Rame actually becomes a member of the Communist Party.
Yet Fo was not a member of this Italian Communist Party. He only supported these ideologies from a distance. He and Franca Rame put on these plays with a group which was called Nuova Scena, and they set up these plays in a private club to avoid state censorship and the intrusion of police during these plays. These plays ended with discussions and debates on the topics raised by the play. Therefore, they interacted with the audience and talked about what happened during those times.
In fact, I think this is very important, because it shows that Fo's work is always about the people who are watching his work, sort of. I mean, for example, if we take another important world event in 1968, is the events of May in Paris, of the students. And basically the demonstrators were students and workers, and it's basically the people who feature in Fo's works.
Yes, and in fact, I mean, 1968, the events in 1968, which were in turn influenced by the Vietnam protests in 1967, certainly had a huge influence on Italy, where they were carried much, much further, because that is the emergence of all the extreme movements, both right and left, isn't it?
Yes, yes. However, I think that before we actually go into detail on Fo's most important work, I think we have to define a very important concept which has a lot of roots in Fo's works, which is the concept of the jester.
Mm-hmm.
Because Fo has a book. It's called the Manuale Minimo dell'Attore, and this was published in 1987. But
it's been translated in English by the Tricks of the Trade.
Yes, exactly, the Tricks of the Trade. Mm-hmm. Basically, Fo believes that the jesters and the minstrels and political clowns, they were actually the people who changed the course of history. In fact, this is why we have a lot of influence from commedia dell'arte and improvisation in Fo's work. And this, the Tricks of the Trade, it was actually recorded talks and workshops and lectures and conferences, and it was actually his wife who eventually edited for the book we have nowadays. I think that one of the most important works of Dario Fo is Mr. Booth.
Which he keeps reworking
exactly.
All the time, actually.
Yes.
I mean, he presents it, and every time he reworks it, I watched about two or three versions of Mistero Buffo when I used to live in Italy, and it's interesting because we will be talking about his Teatro Tenda period, but I've watched it both in a straight theatre like Teatro Quirino and twice at the Teatro Tenda. And every time he sort of nourishes it with the events that are actually happening on the day.
Mm-hmm.
It is important to mention that it's a one-man show and it's the most famous play that he produced. It's based on the jester concept, which Simone talked about. And the language he used was dialects and gramelo. And this gramelo is an invented language, which words that doesn't make sense, or gibberish as we know it now. This play was divided in seven pieces, some parts being from the Bible stories, like the wedding feast of Canaan and the resurrection of Lazarus.
In fact, when later it was restaged, I think it was the third version of Mr. Booth, the Vatican's comment, for example, was that it was the most blasphemous show ever to be put up on stage.
Yes, and it's interesting to hear this gramelo that Franico was speaking about, because in reality he is saying nothing. I mean, it's just a series of sounds, but the intonations, the inflections, the expression, the vocality, and also the physical positions he assumes, which are all, after all, tricks of the trade of the jesters and the giullare, as he is known in Italy, which sort of encompasses this concept of jester and minstrel at once.
Yes.
Okay, in reality, gives it a whole meaning, a whole series of aspects and meanings where the audience knows exactly what he is talking about without him having to say anything very specific. So, in fact, Dario Fo says that probably this type of invented language was also a way to communicate, even in the Middle Ages. I mean, he always traces his origins, as you said, back to the Middle Ages and back to the Commedia dell'arte.
In fact, these dialects, they become very famous throughout Italy.
After
he starts using them.
Yes.
But this, Mr. Booth was in 1969, and this year leads us to another important work. But there are two very important events we have to talk about before we go to them. The first one is what is called Hot Autumn. Hot Autumn basically is when trade unions started improving conditions for workers.
Started fighting to
Fighting,
improve.
Actually, but... I mean, it was something very new. However, it's important to keep in mind, because later on we'll go back to it and we'll see some repercussions of this Hot Autumn, sort of. The second important thing is that in 1969, terrorist outbreaks are reaching a peak. And there are around 173 bomb attacks around Italy. And it's very curious to know that the political sides are blaming each other, sort of. And it's important that in one particular bomb attack, two people are arrested. One of them is called Pietro Valpreda, and the other one is Giuseppe Pinelli. Now, Giuseppe Pinelli is very important because during interrogation, he is in 1970, he accidentally falls off a window, and accidentally, I put that in a lot of inverted commas. Mm-hmm. This accident leads to another important work of his, which is an accidental death of an anarchist, which Franica will talk about.
Mm-hmm. The story is set in the 1920s in New York. The characters that are portrayed are police officers and magistrates, and they are left without a name, with a purpose. Foy uses real contradictory statements declared by the police, which we will...
You will illustrate by reading, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. This play focuses around the maniac, who interprets many persons, the magistrate, the inspector, and himself. This maniac makes fun of all of them, making the two police officers in charge of the maniac despair, and induces them to jump out of the window with the same raptus that the police says that he fell.
That Pinelli had fallen.
Yes. This maniac shows grotesque farcical lengths, and to show that the police did everything to hide the involvement of the right wing, and this is done through the absurd logic he uses. And now we can...
Yes, I'd just like to point out one little thing about the accidental death of an anarchist, which is that it was actually staged in Malta in a particular political time, because yes. After the death of Raymond Caruana, the A Teatro, which had its premises in Tinier, had staged, certainly with a political intent, accidental death of an anarchist. And again, we have what seems to be an accidental it wasn't really an accidental death, but it is interesting to see how this play, which is in itself very political and really questions the right of people to exert that kind of pressure on and to impede other people's freedom, can be adapted to different political situations.
Exactly.
So let's listen to a little reading of it so that our listeners can get an idea of what the play consists of.
Well, this is an excerpt between the maniac and the inspector.
But in the statement here, there's clear indication that when the anarchist was on the ground dying in the courtyard, he still had both his shoes on. On the spot, witnesses testified to that, and there was a reporter from L'Unità among them, as well as a few other passing journalists.
That's odd.
It certainly is. The least the speedy Gonzalez could have done in the circumstances was to rush down the stairs and get to a landing on the second floor, stick his head out of the window as the suicide came flying past, slip the shoe back on his foot and in mid-fight, and then shoot back up like a rocket to the fourth floor, to be there at the same time as the falling man hit the ground.
There you go again, being sarcastic.
I take your point. I just can't help it. I'm sorry. So we're stuck with three shoes. You don't happen to remember if he was a tribe by any chance?
Who?
The railwayman, the suicide, if he had 3 feet. It logically follows that he'd been wearing 3 shoes.
No, he was not tribed.
Please don't get in a huff. Don't forget you can expect anything from an anarchist, even that. It's possible that one of his shoes was too big for him, and he hadn't got any stuffing handy, so he slipped on another, smaller shoe first, and then put on the one that was too big.
2 shoes on the same foot?
Why not? What's so unusual about that? It could have even been a galosh, you know, those rubber overshoes people used to wear.
Used to is right.
Some people still wear them. Do you know what I think? What came off in the constable's hand wasn't a shoe at all, it was a galosh.
No, it's too ridiculous for words. An anarchist wearing galoshes. No self-respecting anarchist would be seen dead in those antiquated conservative things.
Right, so we can see that basically Faure is, through his text, discrediting the police's version of how a political rebel has met his accidental death. What about... can you tell me something about other plays by Dario Faure?
Well, it's important to say that, I mean, this Pinelli case was 1969-1970, but, I mean, the scandal kept going on for a lot of years after, and, again, it still influenced other works. One of them, for example, is Pum Pum Chi è la Polizia?
which is a wordplay. The actors had to keep the scripts in hand, and it was written in 1 week. It was sort of a sequel to Accidental Death of an Anarchist. The story continued about the corruption and cover-ups of the police since the Pinelli affair. this play led further harassment to the group that was staging up this play. At this time, it wasn't the Nuova Scena anymore because it stopped, and it was La Comuna that put it up. Mm-hmm. And they were pressured by the police to stop and put out of the cinema where they were staging it.
And yes, because it is important to note that because Dario Fo was so revolutionary, yes, the theatres refused to have him stage his play. So he ended up going to stage his plays in the cinema. In fact, he used to practice political prices, mm-hmm, which meant that rather than charge people a high price, in order to make sure that many people came to his theatre, and people came to his theatre because they knew it was so repressed, so they were, that was an added attraction. He used to charge very, very low prices, and rather than just, for example, present the play once or twice, he used to present it over 2 weeks. Yes. So rather than work in the theatre when he wasn't accepted into theatre anymore, he moved to the cinemas.
Yes.
So nobody could really silence him. And in fact, in the end, he created Teatro Tenda, which I'm sure you will be talking to us about.
And, I mean, this is very interesting because, I mean, on another level, he was abused not just on a theatrical professional level. I mean, he was abused on a personal level as well. I mean, his wife, at one point, she's kidnapped, she's raped, but I mean, that didn't stop him. In fact, Franca Rame was on stage again about 2 months ago, and she was actually doing a monologue about her experience.
2 months later, you mean?
Yes, 2 months later, yes, after the kidnapping.
In fact, it is, you know, Dario Fo actually writes feminist plays for Franca Rame. And again, we always have this biting satire coming through.
I want to mention a quote, which is what Fo believed in with these plays that he did. "We don't want to liberate the indignation of the people who come along. We want them to keep their anger inside them and not be freed of it, so that they can take actions on events and get involved in the struggle. Anger and hatred must become conscious action in collaboration with others, and not the individual letting off steam in an impotent way." So he didn't want to use theatre to alienate people and let them have fun and forget about their problems. He wanted them to be angry, and then they will fight against it, against their repressions.
Yes, and I mean, this eventually leads us to the final 2 years of this period we've been talking about. And basically, 1974 takes us back to the hot autumn I talked to you about. And basically, all the rights that the unions were fighting for, they were very idealistic on paper, but in practice, they were not actually happening as it was expected, sort of. So there was a severe economic crisis, and people refused to pay. There was a fall in employment. I mean, at one point, we read in a newspaper that housewives felt the need to liberate foodstuff from supermarkets, for example. And this eventually led to another Dario Fo important play, which was Can't Pay, Won't Pay. Mm-hmm.
So what, you know, unfortunately, this is a really interesting discussion, but it has to soon come to an end. What would we say about Dario Fo from 1975 to today?
Well, basically, he kept obviously working on new things. In 1997, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I must say that it was not the general opinion on this Nobel victory was not positive on every front, and so I mean there are a lot of cases where people were really happy for him, others were a little less so.
It's interesting, don't you see, that from 1975 up to 2003, I mean, Dario Fo has become an important name all over the world. I mean, from his plays have been translated into many languages, including Maltese, actually. They've been presented in New York, they've been presented in England, and in many other countries.
Yes, and I mean, even though his communist period is sort of over, he is still attacking politics. I mean, in 2003, he directed an opera, and one of the characters resembled Berlusconi a lot, for example, so he was kind of, he's still in it.
It's interesting, actually. We've been referring to Teatro Tenda all through. Teatro Tenda was a circus tent which Dario Fo put up because no theatre would take him, in the middle of the snobbiest area of Rome, in Parioli. And I watched Dario Fo, as I told you, in two places. What was interesting was that even when he played in the theatre, Dario Fo would ask for a television in his room. And he would listen to the news before the performance. In fact, the performances were always timed just after the news. And the first half hour of his performance, before actually starting any performance was going to start, he would comment in a very ridiculing the politicians and ridiculing Italian politics on stage and speaking about that day's events and linking it to the events of the past few months and also the events of the previous years. Mm-hmm. So it was a very interesting process, and actually people used to go even just to watch that half hour, even though his plays were absolutely fantastic.
Yes. We would just like to end with a quote which Dario Fo said during his Nobel lecture in 1997.
Part of his speech.
His speech. And he says, "Our task as intellectuals, as persons who mount the pulpit or the stage, and who most importantly address to young people, our task is not to teach them method, like how to control breathing, how to use the stomach, the voice, the falsetto, the contracampo. It's not enough to teach technique or style. We have to show them what is happening around us. They have to be able to tell their own story. A theatre, a literature, an artistic expression that does not speak for its own time has no relevance." And I think it's
a good way to end the programme. It's a lovely quote, actually, because he's basically appealing to people's, not only people's techniques, but vis-à-vis the actor, but the actor has the duty, practically, to provoke people into thinking, discussion and action.
Yes.
Thank you very much for listening into this programme. We hope to have you with us next week. Goodbye.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's there?